There is a woman in Caracas right now who may hold more power over the Caribbean's future than any figure since Fidel Castro lit his first cigar. Her name is Delcy Rodriguez. She is 56 years old, a lawyer by training, a politician by survival, and as of April 2, 2026, for the first time in years, no longer on the United States sanctions list. What that headline does not tell you, what almost no headline about Venezuela tells you, is what her removal from that list means for 14 Caribbean nations that have been quietly drowning in energy debt, energy crisis, and energy dependency since the day the deal that protected them finally collapsed. To understand what today means, you have to go back. You have to go back further than the sanctions. You have to go back to where the Caribbean's energy story always begins, with someone else's oil and someone else's terms. The Caribbean sits on almost no significant petroleum reserves of its own. The islands that define this region: Jamaica, Barbados, Grenada, Trinidad's eastern neighbor islands, Belize, Haiti, Guyana, before its recent offshore finds, have historically been prisoners to whatever great power was willing to sell them fuel at rates they could actually afford. In the 1950s and 60s, that was the United States and its aligned multinational oil companies. Then came the Soviet Union's Caribbean client states. Then, for a brief and transformative period between 2005 and 2015, it was Venezuela. Hugo Chavez called it Petrocaribe. He announced it on June 29, 2005, in the Jamaican resort town of Montego Bay. Deliberate symbolism for an initiative that promised to flip the Caribbean's energy dependency from northern exploitation to southern solidarity. Under Petrocaribe, Venezuela would supply crude oil and refined petroleum products to participating Caribbean nations, eventually 18 of them at market price, but with a payment structure unlike anything the international oil market had ever offered these islands. 40 to 50% of the bill was due immediately. The remaining 50 to 60%, deferred for 25 years, at 1 to 2% interest, payable not only in cash, but in goods and services. Rice from Haiti, medical services from Cuba, bananas and citrus from Belize. A barter economy running beneath the formal energy market. For islands with no domestic energy production and no leverage, Petrocaribe was not charity. It was architecture. It built hospitals in Jamaica using deferred oil payment funds. It financed infrastructure in Barbados. It kept the lights on in Haiti during years when the country could not have afforded to pay full market rates for a single tanker. Between 2005 and 2018, Venezuela supplied over 300 million barrels of oil to Caribbean nations under Petrocaribe terms. The United States did not approve. Washington viewed Petrocaribe not as regional development policy, but as Chavez using Venezuelan oil revenue to purchase political loyalty, building a Caribbean bloc resistant to U.S. influence, and gradually aligning those governments with Venezuela's Bolivarian socialist project. They were not entirely wrong about the political intent. Chavez was explicit. Energy was his instrument. But the islands that signed Petrocaribe agreements were making rational decisions. They were not choosing ideology. They were choosing to keep their lights on at a price they could afford. When Chavez died in 2013 and Nicolas Maduro assumed power, Petrocaribe began its slow deterioration. Maduro was not Chavez. The Venezuelan economy, already structurally fragile beneath the oil revenues that had masked it, began to collapse. By 2016, Venezuela was producing less oil than at any point since the 1950s. By 2018, it could no longer honor Petrocaribe supply commitments. By 2020, the program existed only on paper. And in Washington, the architects of Venezuela's isolation had never addressed, not publicly, not on record, why that isolation had been applied with equal force to the islands that simply needed the oil. The Caribbean was left holding the infrastructure that Petrocaribe had built and scrambling to find replacement energy supplies at full market rates. Cuba was the worst casualty. The Cuban government had received approximately 100,000 barrels per day from Venezuela at subsidized rates, which it partially refined and re-exported, using the margin to fund its economy. When Venezuelan supply collapsed, Cuba's entire energy ecosystem went with it. By 2024, Cuba was experiencing rolling blackouts of 16 to 20 hours per day. The island's electrical grid, aging and structurally dependent on Venezuelan fuel oil, was failing in real time. In October of 2024, Cuba's national electrical grid failed entirely for 3 days. 3 million homes without power, hospitals running on failing generators, refrigeration gone. This was not a weather event. This was not sabotage. This was the end stage of a 40-year energy dependency, stripped of its final subsidy. And Washington, under multiple administrations, had contributed to that collapse deliberately. Sanctions on Venezuela's oil sector, imposed first by the Obama administration, expanded dramatically by the first Trump administration, continued under Biden, were specifically designed to cripple Venezuela's ability to produce and export petroleum. Those sanctions worked. They also worked on Cuba. They also worked on every Caribbean island that had built energy infrastructure around Venezuelan supply. The sanctions architects understood this. They argued that the collateral harm was acceptable, even useful, that energy crisis in Cuba would generate political pressure on the Castro government. That argument may or may not have been accurate about Cuba. It was undeniably accurate that it also generated humanitarian crisis in Haiti and rolling price shocks across the Caribbean. Delcy Rodriguez was born in Caracas in 1969 to a family with deep roots in Venezuelan politics. Her father, Geronimo Rodriguez Lobo, was a founder of Venezuela's Movement Towards Socialism Party. She was formed from childhood in the architecture of leftist Venezuelan politics. She became one of Chavez's most loyal lieutenants, served as foreign minister, served as president of the National Assembly. Under Maduro, she became vice president, the most powerful formal position held by a woman in Venezuelan government history. She also became one of the most sanctioned individuals in the Western Hemisphere. The United States Treasury designated her for corruption, for involvement in the manipulation of Venezuela's national currency, and for her role in suppressing political opposition. She was barred from the United States, barred from conducting business with U.S. entities, barred, effectively, from any economic engagement with the dollar-denominated world. For years, that worked as isolation. But Maduro's government survived, however battered. Venezuela continued to produce oil, less than before, but enough to matter. And the geopolitical calculation around Venezuela shifted once again when the Iran war began and the global oil market convulsed, with the Strait of Hormuz disrupted by the Iran-Israel-U.S. conflict. Global oil prices surged in March 2026. The United States, suddenly anxious about energy supply and the political cost of high gas prices, began looking for sources of oil that could move quickly to market without the logistical complexity of Middle Eastern supply chains. Venezuela, sitting on the world's largest proven oil reserves, became, once again, a strategic asset rather than a political liability. On April 1, 2026, the Trump administration removed Delcy Rodriguez from its sanctions list. This was framed, publicly, as a diplomatic opening, a signal that the United States was willing to engage with Venezuela's new acting government. Maduro's formal status had become complicated by months of internal political negotiation, and Rodriguez had emerged as the practical governing authority. The actual driver was oil. And in the background of that decision, the possibility, not yet formal, not yet announced, that something like Petrocaribe could reemerge, not under that name, not with the same architecture, but with the same fundamental logic. Venezuela has oil. Caribbean islands need oil. Some form of preferential access may be possible. This is the moment when Caribbean history becomes visible again to people who only look at the Caribbean when it serves a larger narrative. The 14 nations that participated in Petrocaribe are still carrying the debt they accumulated under the program, the deferred payment obligations that were never fully restructured when Venezuela's supply collapsed. Those debts are legally complicated, disputed, and in some cases have been quietly written down in bilateral negotiations. What they represent, structurally, is the Caribbean's permanent vulnerability to whoever controls the oil they need to function. The mystery thread in this story is not about Delcy Rodriguez's personal politics. It is not even about whether Trump's Venezuela policy is strategically coherent, a question with an obvious answer. The mystery thread is this. In the same week that the United States allowed a Russian oil tanker to reach Cuba and lifted sanctions on Venezuela's acting president, what exactly is being offered and to whom and at what price? Because the Caribbean has heard this before. It heard it when the Soviet Union offered energy solidarity to Cuba in the 1960s. It heard it when Chavez launched Petrocaribe in 2005. It heard it when the United States offered alternatives to Petrocaribe through the Caribbean Energy Security Initiative in 2015. Every great power, when it needs something from the Caribbean, whether access, loyalty, a vote in international forums, a base, a trade route, offers the same currency, energy, at preferential rates, for as long as the great power finds the arrangement useful. What the Caribbean has never been able to build in the four centuries since European colonization reorganized its economy around extraction is an energy system it controls. Trinidad has oil, Guyana now has offshore oil, but the infrastructure for intra-Caribbean energy distribution, for collective purchasing power, for a Caribbean-owned and Caribbean-governed energy compact, that infrastructure does not exist. Every island negotiates alone. The Caribbean community, CARICOM, has aspirations toward energy integration. The Caribbean Development Bank has produced reports. There have been summits. There has been language about a Caribbean single energy market since 2002. 24 years later, Jamaica still imports liquid natural gas from the United States at full market rates, and Haiti still struggles to keep generators running. The last time a Venezuelan tanker full of subsidized oil docked in a Caribbean port, it changed the region for 15 years. The time before that, it was Soviet oil. The time before that, it was Standard Oil of New Jersey. Every great power has understood that the Caribbean can be bought temporarily with energy. What no one has answered. Not Chavez, not Washington, not Delcy Rodriguez, and not any CARICOM summit in 20 years, is the question that sits beneath all of it. If Caribbean nations cannot build energy independence with great power help, will they ever build it at all? And is the answer to that question a reason to keep negotiating or a reason to stop waiting for someone else to solve it?